5 days, and today in particular. So it's really like a discussion of a practical case study of mission and theology in response to the secular age. And it's anecdotal, but well testified. So it'll show how sections of the church have navigated this path, and that one that's been made much harder by a disinterested, disenchanted setting that we live in, but also an increasingly hostile setting. So one of the things struck me maybe 12 years ago, 10 years ago, was going into Baker's Delight, and there was a sign in the window. It was on a Sunday. I went to get a loaf of bread. And from Northern Ireland, that's a very transgressive thing to do, to go in and, you know, sowing seeds or reaping or harvesting, whatever it is on the Sunday. But I went in to get a loaf of bread, and there in Baker's Delight 12 years ago was this sign that said, Baker's Delight is open Sundays. Whatever happened to the day of rest? I mean, yeah, what did happen to the day of rest? It sort of upped and left without me thinking about it, along with, you know, prayer in schools, which we did the Lord's Prayer. We did the Gumnut theology version of it, I think, back in the 70s. And it just upped and left. And I thought maybe the problem is that everyone's disinterested now, and we've got to try and regain interest. So I went back into Baker's Delight with my loaf of bread and said, could I have that sign? And they gave it to me, and I laminated it, and I've still got that sign. My initial thought 12 years ago was that our primary problem was that people would be disinterested in the church and in religion and what we do, never predicting that 12 years later, for 2 weeks, the front page article on the paper had the word Israel and Falau next to each other for about 2 weeks, and the church is a very interesting topic in our Western setting, just a little bit more hostile in that sense. So we're not here merely for the intrigue of it, but because of those of you here today are involved in church and ministry, you've got a vested interest in it. Not simply it's not just an initial question, how have conditions gone from 1500 to now? It's, what are we doing about it? Where are the pressure points for us? How are we solving it? And it's probably good to look at how the church has solved it. Because Jamie Smith, who's one of the disciples, or not an uncritical disciple of Charles Taylor, but he's a Pentecostal background, and he says this at the start of How Not to Be Secular. You're a church planter who's left your Jerusalem on a mission to Babylon. You came with what you thought were all the answers to the unanswered questions that secular people had. But it didn't take long for you to realize that the questions weren't just unanswered, they were unasked. And they weren't questions. That is, your secular neighbors aren't looking for answers for some bit of information that is missing from their mental maps. To the contrary, they have completely different maps. You've realized that instead of nagging questions about God or the afterlife, your neighbors are oriented by all sorts of longings and projects and quests for significance. There doesn't seem to be anything missing from their lives, so you can't just come proclaiming the good news of a Jesus who fills their God-shaped hole. And even if you did, you would be saying you're answering another question there altogether that might have been asked in 1500. They don't have any sense that the secular lives they've constructed are missing a second floor. In many ways, they've constructed webs of meaning that provide almost all the significance they need in their lives. But then he adds in parentheses, though a lot hinges on that word almost. And I think in one sense, church is about leveraging that word almost, isn't it? Everyone's got all the significance they need, almost. It's like the Bob Dylan song most of the time, that he talks, it's obviously about an ex-lover. He's happy, he's getting on with his life. But at the end of every line, he says, most of the time. And we're leveraging, in one sense, that little blip on the landscape, the most of the time, the almost. And you're saying, how do you leverage that in this setting that we're living in as churches? And that's the end result for us as we bump up against secularism 3, that the conditions of belief have changed, but there's an almost. There's a most of the time in there that's causing dissonance in our cultural context. And my wife is a clinical psychologist, and if Marx had said that religion as therapy, well, I'll tell you what, therapy is religion. That's it now. And there's where the almost is getting answered. So we won't cover everything, but we will look at a number of movements, mainly in Protestantism, or reform, as Taylor would put it, because he hinges a lot of the blame on us, okay? You do realise that as you read through the book, that he pinpoints the Reformation and what sprung from that as something that has led to the breakdown, the atomization, and the deconstruction of that bigger rock in the jar of belief and the conditions for it. So the movements that we'll look at in one way expose, in some sense, is Taylor's conviction that the fracture from Rome has been part of the problem, and has led to an increasing splintering, and it's just keeps on splintering outwards that way. So we'll look at these next, the five things that we'll look at. We'll put them through a particular grid. What perceived secular tensions are they trying to resolve? This church expression of, you know, mall, pub, house. Providence won't have any problems with it, so it'll be a shorter session. And church in the monastery, the withdrawal in order to return model. So what tensions was it seeking to resolve? What does it present as a possible solution? Who are some of the people involved? How is it beneficial? How is it detrimental? And sort of what do we learn from it? So as I said, it's going to be a flyover, and if I miss your particular person or hero, there'll be some time for questions and stuff. But over all of these questions, and one that I believe goes to the heart of the matter in the West today, is what is the purpose and nature of the church? What are we here to do? And how these expressions answer that will determine, or how we think about it, will determine how we respond to the secular age in our ministries, what we focus on, what we think needs to be done. But before we do that, I want to put a short video on, which I think, as we start Church in the Mall, explains things pretty clearly.
On the next episode of Church. Nick and Molly just moved to the city and can't agree on what they want. They are young and energetic and looking for a new church home. We'll take some personality tests, tour the sites, ask some questions, and based on taste, experience, and location, we'll find them the perfect congregation. I'm Corey Clark, and welcome to Church Hunters.
We're so excited to find a church. We just started dating.
With the churches we go to now, just not, like, for us, just not really doing it for us, you know?
Right. I go to a satellite campus. I just find it hard to connect emotionally with a video screen. It's just...
Okay, you cry during Cake Boss. So, like, we've been doing a lot of services online, a lot of podcasts. There are a lot of preachers we do like.
Really good, but we want serious yet funny.
Yeah, like commanding of the stage yet relatable, you know?
We're more looking for the humor of Andy Stanley with the body of Stephen Furtick.
Hey, guys.
What's happening?
I'm Corey.
Good to see you. My name's Nick. This
is
Molly.
Hey, guys. Welcome to Church Hunters.
This is your first church. This is Creekside First Baptist. So while it is traditional, it's still pretty current. This year, the pastor started untucking his shirts.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Big deal.
He does dress his age, though, so don't worry. He's past the Osteen suit phase, but he hasn't gone full Giglio yet.
Okay, so it's holes in the knees or no?
Well, it's frayed, but no holes.
Frayed? No. Okay, got it. Yeah. Perfect. Okay.
So, hey, let me show you around. Okay?
Let's
come
do
on.
It.
I do love this lobby.
It's a great lobby. You know, it's not too big, not too small.
Yeah.
Should be enough room to catch up, chat with your friends.
That's all you need.
But here's a great thing. There's a bunch of side exits, so if you need to leave early and catch the game, you can do that.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yes. Honestly, right up front, didn't love the name.
No. First Baptist? Who names a church that anymore?
Not these days. We're looking for like a Thrive Church, maybe Relevant Church, I don't know, Radiant Church, something.
This is the soundboard they use here. Okay. Now remember, it's pretty traditional here. So when Sunday comes around, they turn it way down low.
Got it. Yeah.
But the one knock on this church, they still use the childcare numbering system on the screens.
Ooh, for the
yeah. Or as the moms like to call it, the Sanctuary Walk of Shame.
The Sunday morning experience was just a little too traditional for us.
For us. I mean, the pastor's main point, 157 characters. I can't tweet that.
I really think you guys are going to love this place.
I like
it. We do. We like
Feels
it.
Great.
Yeah.
You know, it's diverse, but it's not like too diverse, you know?
Scripture heavy sermons?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Yeah.
What about, is it community oriented?
Absolutely.
Great.
Oh, women in ministry?
The parking situation, you guys gotta see it. Super rare nowadays. Come with me.
It was like a maybe for when my parents come into town for a church for Christmas, Easter type of church.
Like a holiday type church.
One of the main reasons that I love this church for you guys is that on your personality test, Molly, you scored high in service and hospitality.
Oh, babe.
And there's a great welcome team you could join.
Perfect.
Okay.
And then Nick, you scored really high in need for accountability.
Wow.
And the men's groups here are amazing.
You're just gonna put that out there?
Hey, God knows your heart, okay?
On the next episode of Church Hunters.
I think you're really going to love this place. They take relevance to a whole new level. This church identifies as inter-non-denominational. This pastor speaks out of a brand new translation. It's the
Man, that just like puts the church, that's pinata time, isn't it? It just feels like with Church in the Mall, when we're talking about the whole seeker-sensitive church growth movement, what we're going to talk about in a minute, it's very easy to ridicule it, as like John Chris does there, because it's a convenient whipping boy for all that we see that's wrong with the completely sort of enculturated consumer mentality that drives all those choice things. As Rory was saying before about his parents who go to the Baptist church, they're just not looking for the church to fulfill those things in them. They just would not even, that's not a category for them to think about. But it is now, and it, regardless of whether you think that's good or bad, you do a lot of the things that we're going to talk about next, because it's just, it's the way things have been. You can't live a September 10 world on September 12. That's what I'm saying. Things have changed with the church in the mall, or the way we think about church because of the church growth movement in the culture we're in, that just mean that you just tick a lot of those boxes automatically without thinking about it. And sometimes we're thinking about it as well. I'm not saying that we're doing things that we don't think about. But behind this facade, this monster that's been created in that video, this idea of the mall and the consumer mentality, that the buffered self that Charles Taylor talks about, the person who looks out from within themselves upon an imminent world and makes choices independent of external variables, there was actually a well-thought-out and gospel-driven reason behind the church growth movement, the church in the mall, as I would call it, the mega church, or whatever you want to call it, or at least what birthed these ideas that brought this video to our eyesight today, which you can't now unsee. And there is there's a second one, so you go home and you'll Google it, I know. But we use terms like church growth, people groups, homogenous unit principle, like they're the air we breathe in church settings in the West today, and many of us would be very familiar with them. Yet before the movement that birthed these things was founded, this was an alternate language. This was not the language of the church. The fact that your church might be self-consciously and vociferously opposed to the idea of church in the mall, as I put it, as my trope is, may not have stopped you from setting up a specific church service to reach Australian-born Chinese university students. If that's you, then welcome. You've drunk the mall church Kool-Aid along with everyone else. It may not be poisonous, though, so just be careful. It's not everything has to be thrown out. So we're going to go put church in the mall, or the church growth movement, as it's responded since the early 60s through to now, through the framework that I talked about. What's it done? How's it been beneficial? Things like that. And it won't answer anything or list everything or list all of the players that are involved, but it is a bit of a start. So that's what we're going to do. So any questions, just, you know, I'll stop in a 5 minutes and we can have some questions about some of the stuff that we're doing. So what sort of tensions was this, the movement, the church growth movement, seeking to resolve? Well, especially with the secular ones, secular three that Rory talked about, the conditions of belief having changed so much in the Western framework. It helps to realise that the concepts behind the church growth movement as it sprang up were not born out of the earliest adopters and adapters who were sort of culturally woke in the West. It wasn't a movement that was birthed from looking at what was happening in the Western church primarily to begin with. It was experimented on in the West, but the ideas behind a lot of these things were not born in the West, but from the pre-Christian developing world. Its chief proponents were not looking for an easy gig in a comfortable setting like our friends here in this video. The chief proponents of people who set up the church growth movement ideas cut their teeth on long-term mission. That meant 30 years, not 2 years. You know, back in the 50s and 30s, and 30s to 50s, it meant going somewhere for 30 years. That's what they did. They cut their teeth on long-term mission in difficult places. And the head of that, the grandfather of them all, is Donald McGavran. He was the grandfather of this movement, who was a missionary to India in the 30s through to the 50s. And what he noticed was that when people became Christian in those settings, it was very much the church mission was like the compound, where if you became a Christian, you came there for church, but it did the rest of life for you as well. If you were a Christian in that setting and you become a Christian in India, it sort of fed you, clothed you, educated you, gave you medical aid as well, if you were belonging to the church. And what he looked out around the rest of the place and went, this is very ghettoizing. It's taking people from their cultural setting, bringing them in, they become Christians, but then we do everything for them. We don't do anything out here for these people out here. If you get fed and educated, if you've become a Christian. And it was isolating people away from their own cultural context. And his question was, how do you reach people without making them mini Westerners, so to speak, without giving them the cargo cult aspects of the West as well? How do we stop those things happening? And how do we reach people groups in a way that reaches them with the lowest barrier to accessibility possible for the gospel? That was what was going on. And McGavran came to the conviction that in order to reach people with the gospel, then the barriers to belief, all the extraneous stuff, had to actually be lowered. Now, you think that, of course it does, but that's not what was happening in the 50s in America, or in, well, India, obviously. It wasn't happening there. And central to this was the conviction that the cultural barriers to the gospel were the most problematic barriers of all, that if we could tweak that, if we could lower cultural barriers, then we would see significant growth. We would see that the gospel would go out much quicker, much more successfully than it would if the barriers remain. And that, so those were the central barriers. So without the Western importing of unnecessary barriers, somehow these people in India or wherever could be reached. And that was a gospel imperative from Donald McGavran. And there was more chance of it being taken up and then indigenized. Even the words I'm using at this point, we take for granted. But they weren't taken for granted back in that time. If you think that someone birthed in mission in the 30s in India, pre-war, was thinking through this process over the next 20 years, that's forward thinking. It's done a lot of heavy lifting for a lot of us in many ways. And the fact that you are probably not in your head in agreement, I wrote, you're probably not in your head in agreement at this point, thank you for nodding your head in agreement, shows how much of a legacy that they left. Unreached people group, anyone? You know, been praying for an unreached people group in the suburb next to you? You know, just stop and imagine who they are in your own backyard, and you know you do it. It's ingrained in you. Here's the issue. McGavran comes back to the US in the 50s, and he surveys the landscape, and he's got those glasses on that go, ah, I see tribal groups. I see unreached people groups. They're just Westerners. So part of the narrative of everyone was going to church in the 50s, and then the Beatles came along, and suddenly they were doing it in the road, and no one's going to church, isn't quite the case. There were huge social barriers to gospel in the US at the time, and there were lots of places that were unreached, lots of places that were unreached for the gospel. And he saw that the same barriers to the gospel were there among an increasingly diverse America and a tribal United States, especially at a time when mainline and middle-class churches were becoming isolated from the general population in certain places. This is the time, remember, when the mainlines were like Homer Simpson going across Springfield Gorge. You know, I'm going to make it. I'm going to... And then mainline decline starts to pick up. So he's obviously seeing an issue that's at stake in America that's similar to the third world. So what he does is the same principles in America. So his book, Bridges of God, A Study in the Strategy of Missions, was a key text and published in 1955. So it leaves it on the cusp of the baby boomer-led sexual revolution. We're talking about 8 years before the 1963 point. And it reminds us that not every baby boomer was having too much fun and too much sex. There were some who were actually in church, you know, well-educated or about to be, who were going to lead a movement over the next 30 years. And it was a baby boomer-led movement. And Rory and I were somewhere, year before last, and someone was saying that the generation of megachurch leaders in America, there aren't the people coming to replace them at the same size of church, and they're starting to break the church units down into smaller settings because you get more bang for your buck. The main megachurch pastors are dying or retiring, and they're not being replaced by the same kind of people. So McGavran was really important for this. It was critical. And his work was taken up by C. Peter Wagner, who built upon it, which I think is, this is where the shift came. McGavran's thinking, how is this working? And how, what am I, what theological principles am I putting in this? What kind of things can we put together from the Bible about it? And he went on to Fuller, where he was head of missions there at Fuller Seminary. And his disciple, as he would call him, Peter Wagner, built upon his work and took over that role at Fuller as well. But the difference between, say, McGavran and where Wagner went with it was that Wagner built a more nakedly market-driven church growth movement. Your church can grow. The keys to church growth, et cetera, things like that. And there was a whole list of books that he put out with the word growth in the title suggesting this. And here's the issue. The key issue for them is the church has stopped growing. And there are things that we need to do to put in place that we can actually put in place, that we can actually tweak, that aren't gospel, that can actually break open those barriers to church growth. And there's barriers to church growth. Now, I'm old enough to have prostituted myself at every evangelical shrine over the last 25 years and every high place in Asherah pole. So my experience is working in a Baptist church where this stuff 25 years ago was key, was absolutely key. I've also been involved in the house church movement. Know Alan Hirsch from the Forge movement, friends with the guy who was the head of Forge National in Australia, moved to England to work with the Crowded House, now back at Providence, and I've written stuff with that Rod Dreher has quoted. So I feel like I've done the whole gamut. I'm shameless, you know. But I've seen these movements come and go like this. And 25 years ago, as a young guy in the Baptist church, the church growth thing, people coming from America to Australia to say, here's what you need to do to unlock the problem that you've got. Now, you can straight away see American exceptionalism. Everyone in America, the amount of people going to church in America and the few people that were going to church in Australia, it seemed, it felt like we had somehow been given the key to make our churches look a lot bigger in Australia. It felt like that was what was happening. And both Wagner and McGavran and the disciples that followed them were keen to arrest the decline of this growth. And so what they'd done is say, let's figure out which things we need to tweak. It's a thoroughly modern way of doing it, because if you know the model, it took on a very strong business model. And there's something implicitly plausible and modern about saying, we're going to leverage this with a business model. We're going to say, we don't need elders. We need a board of management, et cetera, which is going to solve this issue, because that's how businesses are growing. They started to pull those levers a lot stronger. So they were seeing that it was a bad thing for the church to accept that decline is inevitable. And you'd have to say, okay, you know, if you think that's a good thing, put your hand up now and then leave the room. See, the church growth movement was sitting between two opposing problems. First, there was the perception, and some of it was reality, that the more conservative churches were happy to leave conversions to the sovereignty of God alone. So the gospel's a really high barrier, but let's add a few more. Let's put a few more barriers in there to make sure. So we'll make it harder. And the church growth movement was saying, you've got to lower some of those barriers. But secondly, and I think this is where McGavran was getting it right, the mainline churches were already starting to go into decline, and they were pushing the Missio Dei theology. That's a term taken up more recently by the emerging church movement as well, which was emphasizing social justice matters over evangelism, or at least as important as evangelism. And McGavran was, no, people are lost, they need to hear about Jesus. So those are key elements as to how the church growth movement started. McGavran could see that not just around the rest of the world, but in his home patch, upon his return, something had changed. And that's going to be key over the next couple of days as we look at a few movements and a few people in it. Leslie Newbegin, for example, and people like McGavran, that it takes them, they go out of the culture for 20 or 30 years and they come back and they go, whoa, something happened, something changed. It just doesn't feel the same as when I left. And Newbegin's the prime example, and we'll talk about him later in the week, of, wow, you know, I came back to the West and realized it needed to be evangelized, and it was as much as where I'd come from for the last 30 years. But it takes you to go out for 30 years, doesn't it? You can't do it on a short-term mission trip or even 2 years. It takes that long sweep where you have a set of assumptions. Excuse me. Now, near where I live, there's a Romanian Baptist church, and it's got the Romanian colored flag, and everyone who came and left the Ceausescu regime in the 70s goes to the Romanian Baptist church, and they wear not even itchy pants, itchy suits, and the itchier the better, you know, because it makes you look more grumpy and more sort of like you're lining up for dumplings in Belgrade or somewhere, you know, and they all go there, and it's atrophied. It's just stayed exactly the same. And the biggest problem that Romanian Baptist Church in Perth has is that all these young Romanians leave Romania now and they come to Perth, and the first port of call is the Romanian Baptist Church. And they walk in, young Romanians who've been to an evangelical church in Romania, and they walk in and it's as if the choir is standing up to sing the first hymn. Let's do the time warp again. You know, it's like, whoa, that feels like communist Romania from 30 years ago, because it just sat there and atrophied. And in one sense, McGavran and Newbegin come back, and the shock for them is that, oh, it hasn't stayed like it. Things changed over 30 years. It feels like if you pull these levers like we did last time, it should all work the same way. But suddenly it seemed like the message and the method was sliding off like Teflon. And the whole key was, how do you make Teflon into Velcro again? How can you make this thing stick again? And that was crucial to their thinking about how to unpack this. So the baseline solution is, this is what he said in Bridges to God, McGavran says, we must make sure that we ask people to become Christians where they don't have to cross barriers of language and culture and class and wealth and style of life. Obviously, if you're a poor person living in a slum in India, that's a great message, and because it says, come as you are. But maybe for a really wealthy white American, and it says, you don't have to change anything, we can get you a whole bunch of people that look like the country club plus Jesus, that may not be the best thing. That may not be the best thing. See, over and above any other goal, the goal of the church growth movement, or Mall Church, was to ensure that the only offense to someone becoming a Christian was the gospel itself. It self-consciously, and in this sense has a truly postmodernist tone, checked its privilege at the door. It says, okay, in one sense we're going to say, we can see that we're doing something with this group of people that is putting barriers in place, and we just assumed those barriers were just neutral. Because, hey, why wouldn't they be neutral? I live like that, they live like that, but not everyone lives like that. So they said, you've got to try and deal with that. And that led naturally to the big rock in the jar for that movement, the homogeneous unit principle, which on the positive side of this, insofar as McGavran taught it, was that people were more likely to be at ease and therefore more receptive to the gospel if they were around people similar to themselves. Diverse but not too diverse, right? Diverse but not too diverse, as we saw. So McGavran in India and Wagner, who was in Colombia, were convinced that reaching people groups would be the way to see the gospel take root quickly in a location. Find people that look pretty much the same. There's lots of people like them, tribally, and we could reach them with the gospel so there's no barriers. We go straight in and you don't have to deconstruct a whole lot of cultural stuff that people don't take for granted. They believe that the gospel can come to one people group at a time and had a better strike rate. You would get more people converted. So that was absolutely key, the homogeneous unit principle, to how they did things. And you can see, look, put up your hand if you've had that discussion in any sense in church, because we have. Do we have an evening service for this kind of people? And I'm not even saying these things are good or bad. I'm just saying how much they have bled into how we think about how church it happens. That's just the way we do it now. You can't go back to a McGavran time and think there's no such thing as a homogeneous unit principle, because it's a conversation in every church. And we do it when we go to university campuses, we do it wherever. We think, how do I reach this group of people? Well, we'll put church on the way that has no barrier other than the gospel. We've said it, let the only offense be the offense of the gospel. We say it all the time. So that was crucial to their understanding. Questions at this point or comments? Anyone? Nathan.
You mentioned Jibigan, and you pick up on it later. It seems there's a decade between the government going back to the US
and
Jibigan to the UK.
Yes.
How much is their approach shaped by that decade, and how much by where they return?
I think that's a big issue, and you've paid up to find out, haven't you? Yeah.
So.
Look, I think what is interesting about Jibigan is he's less. He's less optimistic about how secularism, how the playing field in one sense. So he comes back, and he's obviously a great thinker, and his key issue, and we'll talk about this, is that we haven't returned to really a secular place. We've returned to a place full of gods in the West, and that has changed the whole landscape. And so he deconstructs a guy, is it Dennis Mundy? I keep forgetting his name. I've got it in the week in day three, I think. But what he said, there's this list of six things that secularism was going to do. It was going to pluralize everything, make it so that the politics of the land would withdraw from any interest in what was happening religiously in a place, and it would be a much more equitable, tolerant society. And he just deconstructs every one of those and said, huge assumptions. Huge assumptions. It's like reading Proto-Taylor, in one sense, when you read chapter 17 and 18 of The Gospel in a Pluralist Society. Just read those two chapters. They're very short, chapters 17 and 18. He just deconstructs the secular conviction that it somehow will create a much more open framework for people to think and move in, because it's a subtraction story, because it's a place where everyone can flourish on the same foundational level. But it is interesting that he goes back to the UK, and you know that Tim Keller also says that Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones picked it up in London, which it would be in London, of course, because that's the place where, you know, it all happened earlier, that it's already happening there, late 50s, early 60s. But there's obviously a bigger machine of Christianity involvement in America that took a bit more time. So there's a homogeneous unit principle. Any other questions? Sorry. Are there? Well, the idea of a teenager as a subset and a grouping is probably something that rose in the 50s. You think of all these movies, West Side Story, all those things with the teen as a product and someone to be marketed to, is something that strongly came up post-war and then boomed with the boomers. And so suddenly, the whole idea of those homogenous unit principles being having a specific need, a specific way, came into play. And they were, A, seen as a group to be marketed to by secular marketing, but that you can't put the genie back in the bottle. That's going to flow on into church. There's no way around that. So it's interesting how the movement, you think about the 50s and 60s, you think you're talking Mad Men here as well, aren't you? You're talking about a whole secular movement as well, and a whole marketing arm of culture that breaks groups down into identifiable target market areas. And it had to affect how the church went, because it affected how we were as people. You can't live discreetly. This is my church way of thinking, and this is my other way of thinking. It broke all that down, or it just filled the space that was broken, I think. So, whether or not you have a kids ministry or don't, that's not necessarily a question you were asking the same way. And if you think about Sunday school, it was started for kids who were outside of church before it was ever started to be the thing that you must have one for your kids in church. A different way of thinking about it. Sunday school as we think about it, not as American thinks about it. I'll push on, but we'll have time for questions and stuff afterwards as well. But we'll have another 10 minutes and we'll have some more questions. The second thing that they brought into was the receptivity principle, or what they call harvest theology. And there was a conviction that if there was a lack of receptivity among a certain group, then don't waste too much time there. Not for them, go to a people group in the 1800s with your wife and three kids and have them die of malaria within the first week and you stay for the next 50 years for two converts. None of that. It wasn't that way of thinking. There were plenty of receptive places, and the Holy Spirit would lead his people to those places, both domestically and abroad. So that was the key. Find the receptive people groups and plant yourself there. And this is what McGavran says. Africa south of the Sahara will soon be as Christian as North America. I probably didn't get that wrong. The Holy Spirit leads us to ripe harvest fields. He also calls us to many which have yet to be sown. The great day of Christian mission, in which Christians of all six continents will spend themselves, is dawning. We can at least set a good example for other concentrations of believers to follow. You've got to admire that, because that does not sound like, how can I do church in the safest gated community in America that provides me with good coffee? That sounds like get out there and give it a crack, doesn't it? It does not sound like what that video looked like or what we assume things have become. It did have a pragmatic approach, but you know, this wasn't coming into the most pragmatic era of conservative evangelicalism in the world. It said that growth was good, God wants a harvest, so don't pump your money into dead-end causes. That's what it was taking on at that time. The other thing, and this comes through in the later generations, especially through Peter Wagner, was this fact, data is your friend. And if you have been to any conference which is about church growth, it's about data. Gather as much data about, and you do it as well. You want to plant a church? You go to the local council and you get the demographics of that area, don't you? Isn't that what they're saying? That idea did not come down with the golden tablets to Joseph Smith and then get left on the ground for them to pick up. That's come from the church growth movement, from Peter Wagner, people like that. Under the leadership of Wagner, the movement takes this new marketing and advertising technique, Mad Men for Church. Church has a few Mad Men, but this is Mad Men for Church, and it utilized those in order to extract principles by which the church could, and I use this word, guarantee that it could grow. Okay? I'm going to use that word carefully because I think that's part of the salvation narrative of the church growth movement to churches that are struggling in the West, that if you pull these data levers and you get these plates spinning in certain ways, tucked in shirt but not ripped jeans, a little bit hipster, but a bit old, could be a dress, talking about someone on this very moment. But that's what's going to do it. That somehow will be open the door to the lack of growth or the presence of decline in your church. In his Wagner's 1984 book, Your Church Can Grow, clearly indicated that there were certain tried and true principles that would, in normal circumstances, ensure that your church did, your church can grow. You can just see why that flew off the shelves. The movement becomes aligned with data, statistics, and strategic marketing at a time that the secular culture was utilizing those tools as well. So it was, in one sense, saying we're pillaging from the Egyptians and taking those marketing tools. That's how it was seen. And if you read, there's a great description of this book in 1984. Is your church healthy, vibrant, and growing, or is there something missing? It's, are you feeling dynamic and resourceful, or is something missing? That could be an ad for, hair transplant. But drawing upon 20 years of experience in the biblical and scientific analysis of church growth, Dr. Wagner shows you how to read the vital signs of your church and how to bring people into responsible church membership. Wow, that does sound fairly simple in one sense. The role of the pastoral team leader of a church was to acquaint themselves with this analysis and know the vital signs well enough to predict where things may head up or down in terms of growth. Hence, further titles from Wagner included Strategies for Church Growth, Your Spiritual Gifts Can Help Your Church Grow. You can see that the primary problem was the church is in decline and there are methodologies that you can put in place outside of supernatural methodologies that are tested and proven. That if you can just spin all of those plates the right way, somehow these things will line up and your church will grow. Do you see how that works? And do you see how many of those things you automatically assume in the way you do church already? Good, conservative, expository preaching evangelicals that we are. Unless there's an outlier in here somewhere. We know who you are. I'll throw it open to comments about how that makes you feel. I hate to say that word in this secular age, but do you sense some recognition in yourself in some of that, surely? No? Yeah? Don't worry, there's absolution later because we're all becoming Catholics again, apparently, aren't we? But it feels like we took a lot of that stuff and we said, in fact, we didn't. Here's my experience. Baptist Church, 25 years ago, went to a Bill Hybels conference. Not so what you'd do today, but all my crowd, you know, trained in a good conservative college, poo-pooing everything that was up there because he was taking the Bible and he was using principles from Nehemiah about church growth. And one of our friends, who shall remain nameless but is still a great guy in ministry, went up to Bill Hybels at the end with his book, Bible, opening it to Nehemiah and said, "Do you really think the text is about that?" Bill Hybels looked at him as if he was some animal that he hadn't seen before, and it was an awkward conversation. Our friend was young and kind of impetuous, but we were sort of poo-pooing a lot of that stuff 20 years ago, and my goodness me, we rushed to it about 10, but our way, of course, I think, and I do think that. I think that we poo-pooed it for a long time and then realised there were some things that we probably needed to learn, and we weren't very humble about that either. Okay, I just say that. I was. I don't know about the rest of you.
Was there success in terms of, because they say, but in America, you know, you start up, you plant a church, you've got 500 on the first Sunday. Like, is there something about the culture in America where it was successful that, say, in Australian context, have been the most successful?
Yeah, I think the video store does come into it a little bit. Did it grow more Christians or did it shift the Christians around? And I was going to use the King of the Hill video, which you've probably all seen, where Hank and his family go to a new mega church after being in the sort of mainline Methodist church for years. And, you know, they can't find a church. He's had a fallout. And so they go to all these different churches. And the first church they rock up to, it's his boss's church, who's, you know, Hank's boss has just really stayed, and they go in there, and the guy, it's Pentecostal to the full, and there's his boss screaming something out, ripping his shirt off and throwing it in the air, and it lands on Hank's head. It cuts to the next week, and they go into a Catholic church, which is in Spanish, and he's standing up at the wrong moment, sitting down at the wrong moment, looking around him at the wrong moment, and the next week they go to this obviously mainline church, and they all open the door, and they hear this, day by day, and they just close the door and walk gently. And then the next week they find the mega church, and he's saying, "Well, the coffee's good, but would Jesus really, you know, endorse Nat King Cole? And you know, it's everything you dream of in the mall that you want, and it's full of people. It's got a plausibility structure to it. And part of what we think about in the secular frame is the plausibility structures, the conditions for belief. And so, steeped in a mall culture, as Westerners obviously, you know, we are. There's just no way around that." Mall culture, mall church has a plausibility. It creates conditions for belief in one sense that make it seem more plausible. And when you put a leadership team in that setting who have a business model of an executive and a board, it doesn't sound like elder. Because if you're a 2019 secular person and you hear there's the elders in the church, you kind of think you're going to open the door and see these guys in pointy hats with, you know, whole, you know, that feels like that. But if you know there's a boardroom there where there an executive meets, you know this, they're probably not cooking the books. They're probably not killing the kids, though we don't take anything for granted. Do you know what I'm saying? It's got a plausibility to it. And I think in Australia, and this is not anecdotal, well, it is anecdotal, but it is true. Someone we know coming from a church planting movement in the US, one of three people who went out at the same time, two planted in the US and have supporters from the home church. One plants in Rockingham, south of Perth, which is tough, you know, tough scrabble area, as you'd put it, and he's got the same 20 that he had 5 years ago, and the supporters are writing, "How come their churches have got 400 and yours has got 20? What are you doing wrong? Why are we still supporting you?" And he feels the tension. So there's obviously something going on different in the way church is happening in those places. But it in one sense, the American model just proves that Christians are moving around a little bit more. It doesn't necessarily mean it's growing, because it might be that big churches are getting fuller, little churches are staying. If you really want little church, you'll do little church. But medium-sized churches are under pressure because they're looking up at that one and down at that one, and they're sort of falling in the middle, which if you watch the King of the Hill video, which I might show, it has that problem. They're going to a church that's just a little bit lame, and it's just not working. And they can suddenly go to a church where the football game is on the big screen afterwards. It seems plausible. You'd invite your non-Christian friend to that, perhaps, in one sense. Now, I'll push on. Some of the main players, you got Wagner and McGavran, who ended up at Fuller Seminary. But there are a lot of players of this across the theological spectrum. There's the great irony, is that, especially in America, those church growth principles were taken on by people from very different theological frameworks. If you think that Robert Schuller was one of the earliest mega pastors on TV, and his church, Crystal Cathedral, was known for its enthusiasm for what? Norman Vincent Peale, Power of Positive Thinking. Yeah, it was massive, absolutely massive. But that doesn't stop, you know, a large mega church with a much more conservative theological framework popping up. So the conditions for creating them weren't necessarily theological. There was something else going on. You've got Bill Hybels, former senior pastor now. Think about, and we might process during the time, or think about, how did it get to the stage it got to, where the leadership team was divorced from the congregation that much, that some of the things happened at Willow Creek that have happened. Before the church, his church was 24,000 people. 24,000 people. And it is, to some extent, defined by the baby boomer foundation upon which it was built. And his comment, Bill Hybels' comment about the 30th anniversary of his church, is instructive. 30 years ago, he says, we were in a movie theater and thought it was so cool because we were finally delivered from the horrors of stained glass and wooden pews. And what do all the young people want today? Stained glass and wooden pews, people. They want, give me something that has a connection with the past. Isn't that an irony? Give me liturgy or I die, you know? So it was very boomer-led, and you can see where it came out of. It's the, you know, it is the Christianized version of the sexual revolution, though ironically the sexual revolution ideas have taken down many of the leadership within the community of that. You got Rick Warren, Saddleback Church, and the author of 40 Days of Purpose. Key issue we're just talking about, what's the point of my life? Can you imagine in 1500, the priest going, well, actually, we're going to a book called 40 Days of Purpose, because I know you're a peasant, but I can see if you had a dream, you could be more than a peasant. You know? You could be more than a peasant. I was in a Baptist church at the time that this came out, and I was probably being a little bit surreptitious and trying to, you know, I had to preach from one of the sermons. So I think, how can I squeeze that into an exegetical expository sermon on this passage? It was interesting. You got Joyce Meyer, Joyce Meyer Ministries. Notice it's not called First Baptist Church. It's Joyce Meyer Ministries. Huge. Joel Osteen of Lakewood Church, author of Your Best Life Now. Now, you thought, they're not theologically anywhere near us. Who cares? The average pagan who never goes to church thinks that Mormonism is exactly what we are like as well. I know that because reading in a New Zealand newspaper last week, where a New Zealand journalist is saying that the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinta Ardern, who left Mormonism at the age of 21 because of its view on sexuality, is well qualified to speak about Christianity and what it believes about sexuality in the world. I thought, wow, I've never thought that a Mormon would be well qualified to speak about Christianity, in the same way that I don't think that I'm the person you should go to talk about Mormonism, or because I just don't know enough about the intricacies of it. But that's how the world views us. So in one sense, in this secular world, the idea was to launder out of the church all of those barriers, the theological barriers, the crazy language, the funny clothes, those sorts of things, because it would give a plausibility and let us jump into the next generation. You know the way there's some artists that made it through the 90s and then they get another kick? U2. REM did it for a while, but they got burned out by 2010 and they were done. The trick is, how do I get to the next generation? How do I make it to the next decade? And that's what this way of doing church was doing. And then you get figures like George Barna, who's part of the movement as the research guy. He's the guru for research. And you've used his stuff, okay? You've heard him quoted. And the Barna group was looking at research methodologies around church and faith and giving information data as to how to make your church grow. And his book, Marketing the Church, you'd never get away with writing that now, surely, Marketing the Church, it applied principles of marketing and growth that he had learned while working for who? Disney. Interesting. So that's how it started. Now, how was it beneficial, or is it beneficial? Well, it's easy to look back at the foundations of the movement and point out the blind spots that couldn't be seen and the sometimes unhelpful roads that the direction set have taken us. But the movement was the first to recognize that the cultural landscape in the West had really changed drastically and that there were barriers to people coming to church that were cultural, that things had changed, that it wasn't just a monolithic one-size-fits-all kind of people group in America or the West anymore. And Ed Stetzer, who you've probably read quite a bit of, says this of McGavran. McGavran's challenge was to dig into existing relational networks. Do not encourage believers to isolate themselves from their greatest place of gospel influence, their family and neighbours. That was a missiology question, and it assumed that missiology, with its research, sociology and cultural understanding, has some value. And I think that's a good point, that you have to figure those things out. You've got to dig into existing relational networks with people. The house church movement, much of that was get your non-Christian friends into your network of Christian relationships over a period of time. Get people to know each other. Smooth down some of the barriers to why they may not want to take Christianity seriously. So there was mission action. It took the call to make disciples of all nations seriously when it started. It was very much, we ironically think of it as a Western thing that's been transplanted to other nations, maybe South Korea, for example, and in China, though they're starting to blow those churches up, so that's going to change things a little bit. That'll change things again. And it funneled time and resources in a mission direction. A mission direction. And it was a constant call to reach more people. The most conservative, theologically orthodox wings of the church in Australia see that as almost their central thing. We are here to evangelize people. Your job is to evangelize. When you're at work, your job is to see for opportunities to evangelize. That all has come out of the church growth framework of thinking of how is this a mission field? How is this West a mission field? It highlighted the barriers to gospel witness. It named the cultural barriers that you don't see yourself. And it highlighted people groups as important in the West. That there are people groups in the West, even if you look the same, you don't think the same. The Universe Next Door, perhaps you've read that book. And it was keen to put the gospel into the vernacular language. And it was entrepreneurial, which isn't something we've been noted for, I might add. It was pragmatic, not afraid to fail, and not afraid to quit something that isn't working. And in the best of hands, that can be a great thing, I think. It just says you're not so tied to that you have to keep doing it even if it's achieving nothing. And it did respond to mainline decline in the United States especially, and it established that the gospel message is important and that it will lead to social justice rather than saying we can get to the gospel via social justice, because it said that's not working and the gospel that you're giving in the mainlines isn't the gospel that we want to promulgate. And it was post-denominational. This is probably critical, the baby boomer time. Post-denominational in a world mistrustful increasingly of institutions. Who calls your church First Baptist anymore? You know, it's got to have, you know, a name of a Greek name or something, or a name like from the Bible, like Providence even, you know. Second Providence, First Providence. First Providence, or yeah, Third Providence. Sorry, Mike, you might, we'll fight it out later. But how is it detrimental? This is the key. The great irony of the movement, and I think this is critical, and a great irony, has been the accusation that what began from observing the mission station approach to gospel work overseas, where the extra goodies of the gospel, health, education, food, are available to those who sign up, has led to the gated community church where you can go from cradle to grave in a subculture. That if you join that, all the benefits are open to you. And it feels they've done exactly what it tried not to do. That's at its worst expression, obviously. But there's always that pull away from generally living out there in the world to everything is going to be looked after for you by this church setting. And that's, you know, the video just shows that. Can you tick all these boxes for me? Can you do all these things for me? And if you do, we'll attach ourselves tightly to this and we'll live, move and have our being around the kind of gated community that it is, the cradle to grave idea. And it's instructive that even the term church growth movement has become tainted in light of concern over the pragmatic numbers only practice. And Ed Stetzer highlights three problems within the movement. He says it's been Americanized, it's monocultural, a lot of it. The mission station problem, the ghettoization, and the sociological problem, it was a gospel by numbers and stats. So I felt very strongly 25 years ago, the good news proclaimed to me at those conferences that we went to as young bucks in the Baptist church, was the good news wasn't the gospel. The good news was that your church can grow, and here's how. It felt like that. And of course it goes without saying that the gospel is the most important thing. That prefaced every second conference you go to. But here's the way to ensure that your church can grow. And all of us in Perth, where church was hard and it was in decline, were sitting scribbling notes. And then going back to our elders or whoever and saying, we're changing everything. So most Baptist churches in Perth are congregational in idea only, in history only, because they're not run that way anymore. Just not the way a Baptist church is run in general. It's a leadership team, a board, an executive. And that brings us to another issue. Even at the level of church polity, we've laundered out the language that we use to describe who we are. And one of the charges against the church growth movement was that it said it was about gospel, but eventually it went to that, it laundered out language so that it's understandable. But when you lose language, you lose a lot of things. And at the very time that I think language is the battle we're having in the public square, who gets to define what terms mean what? At that very time that we should have doubled down on how we use language, the church growth movement says, how can we make this less about specific language? And I think that's been something that those churches have lost in a big way. Very important to remember that. In order to gain more converts, the movement tended to shy away from the language of faith, believing that this would make it easier for newcomers to come to the door. However, the result has been a thin understanding of the faith and its connection with the past. And we're starting to see that played out, as we will tomorrow and the next day and on the last, not the last day, capital T, capital L, but on Friday, how there's been a desire for a return to something that's based in the past. And that's not something that was celebrated much from 1963 onwards. It was the age of Aquarius. It was the dawning of a new age, which is going to put the old age behind it. And now what you're getting is people asking for something that was back then. Something back then. So Ed Stetzer names the biggest problem as methodological mania, the belief that if the methods are followed, then growth, and by that he means conversions, will follow. And that kind of seems to be underplaying the role of the Holy Spirit. And there are other concerns that I think spring from this. That means that the church growth movement model isn't well positioned for countering secularism 3. It's that search for customers. Are you satisfied or extremely satisfied? You know, they ask you on the welcoming pack. It tends to, if it's not careful, head towards pragmatism, what works rather than what is right. And perhaps the biggest charge is that it taps into that who am I, what's my purpose, felt need thing more than anything else. It's an individuated, privatized gospel for the individual. It doesn't have a high view of church in some senses. It runs church very, very well, but doesn't have a high view of the church, that you are joining something that's bigger than you and that you don't necessarily make the decision of how that's played out in church. Because you all know that people come to your church and they come to my church, and no matter where they're from another church, one of the things you have to launder out of them is that they're going to stay for as long as they feel that this is working for them. And you think, well, what levers do I need to pull to make sure they feel that it's working for them? That's a hard one to break. Very hard one to break. And in one sense, the offense of the gospel gets laundered out of it. I heard Bill Hybels say, don't use the word lost, because Americans don't like to be described as being lost. That's interesting. Well, as I said this morning in Brisbane, I was lost. And I couldn't remember where I needed to go. And I didn't know where I was. And being lost is a dangerous thing. If you're lost, you need to know that you're lost in order to know what it means to be found. So in one sense, they took all that out of it. And it was almost a therapy model for what was going on. That's a blanket statement, because it's not always like that. But the primary concern is that, as Taylor has observed in the Age of Authenticity, which is a chapter we'll look at, the models of faith and spirituality that are being promulgated in the setting begin with the buffered self, in which each individual is an independent agent who determines their own pathway from a range of options. The gospel can then be reduced to finding ways to tap into that individual framework for each person and going with that. What is your felt need on this issue? 6 sermons on marriage, 5 sermons on giving or whatever, because those are the things that are going to be reaching people. Now, in one sense, those 6 sermons on marriage, 5 sermons on giving or financial management were actually supposed to be gospel opportunities for you to bring your friend to a church expression that wasn't going to be weird, where they are struggling with their finances. Hey, that's okay. In our church in the next month, we're talking about 5 points of how to manage your finances. It's very bait and switchy at that point, but that's what it was designed to do. But as someone in the movement said, they were very good at getting people in the door, but deep discipleship wasn't happening. So what they discovered is that the harvest theology was getting people through a door, lowering the barriers as much as it could. But when one of the barriers to the gospel is the gospel, you've got to decide, am I going to keep that barrier in or am I going to take that barrier out? And that's a harsh call, but I do think the task of discipling people away from one way of living towards another wasn't adequately addressed in that model. So the Sunday service became the gateway for non-Christians, and everyone will come on Wednesday night to a Bible study. But as you know, I think you'd know, the shop front window of what you actually do and believe and practice in the rest of your week is what you do in your main gathering. It reflects so much else. So if Sunday isn't doing it, you can guarantee the rest of the week won't do it, because it will model what's happening in the main meeting. Any questions, comments? And before I wrap up. Yep.
Do you think, like, the church growth model simply recreated the nominal kind of Christian church that existed before, as in, you know, before 1963 secularization? Because it isn't an attempt to return to the cultural Christianity of the past. Like, was deep discipleship happening pre?
Well, that's a really good question. Was deep discipleship happening? Well, this is the thing, the books that you're reading now, and this is what Rory was alluding to, is that there once was a time when everyone was zealous for Jesus. It was in 37 AD, or it was in 340 AD, or it was in 1600, you name it. And there was once that time, the golden era. But in this narrative of decline, no one's zealous for Jesus anymore. So we need to write a book called Radical, perhaps, or something like that, that's going to tap into the, hey, I've read it, I'm not ashamed. Look, and in one sense, that's part of the process. Is when you read Taylor, what you notice is that the Catholic Church had a lot of ropey people in it who were, into magic and fairy dust and sleeping around. It wasn't this golden age in that sense. So the deep discipleship thing has been a little bit of a myth down the time, but it also depends what we think deep discipleship is. What do we think deep community is? Well, if you live in a Western society, it's probably doing house church and you're, whoa, ninja Christian, You know, I'm a ninja Christian. I'm doing household church. We meet four times a week. Whereas Tim Keller tells the story of Elizabeth Elliot, you know, living in a tribe where they don't have walls. What do you want walls for? You trying to hide something? Yes. You know, I'm sleeping in the same apartment he is, and we've got two bathrooms, and I don't think we'd cope if we didn't. You know, he's got two bathrooms. I go outside. Yeah. And it's like, whatever you think the problem is, you're going to throw something at it that looks like a solution. And I think part of the deep discipleship thing that we'll get to tomorrow and Wednesday is saying, this model didn't create disciples, so we needed to do something with it. It's not geared us up for the world that's coming. But part of the issue is, as you're rightly saying, there's never been a golden age where everyone went to church and when everyone was involved. If you look back in America, 1776 was the lowest time of percentage of people going to church in America, whereas you think it's done that. But the secularism model says it's been a bit more like that. The narrative of progress is that history is like a cable car. You're just going like that. And your job is to get on the right side of history, right? History is a roller coaster. And if you strap yourself in for a cable car ride and you get a roller coaster, you're going to think something's wrong, right? Probably why the Western narrative is going to fall apart at some stage. But I think that's more like the church as well. Oh, it's done that. There's been movements. And Steve Addison from Melbourne, who some of you may know, has just got a new book out, which I'm going to review. The rise and fall of movements. Because it's going to do this. There's going to be no cranking of any lever that's going to be the golden thing that's going to do it. And I think you're right that how we think history is played out in that discipleship thing determines what we think needs to be the solution to what we're doing. And there hasn't been that golden era. Phil.
So, Steve, along those lines,
yeah.
And I'm sad I'm not going to be here to hear the grand solution at the end.
StephenMcAlpine.com. No. No. Yeah.
But a whole lot of us probably wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for having been through that phase. And a lot of the churches that didn't listen to any of that stuff
are shut.
Just aren't around
anymore. I know.
And we're here because we're here. And sure, there'll be next things and there'll be and things will change and we'll need to modify. But maybe we just need to keep doing that.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. And I think part of the problem is always that we judge. We take an internal assessment of how we're going, and we're never realistic with our own internal assessments, I guess. So the charge 25 years ago that our crew, you know, the strong, you know, eat your, you know, oatmeal kind of crowd were into was, that's just rubbish. That's just pragmatics. And then 15 years later, when they're pulling the same levers and they're struggling, they're going back to those, you know, going to secondhand bookshop and buying those books. And in one sense, if we've been able to work together and say, yeah, but you should, expository Bible teachings, you're going to need it because you're going to thin your people out with six sermons on this and five sermons on that. You're not going to grow people who understand the depth of the gospel in a way that's going to transform them. I think that's crucial. So we could have learned from both. But I'm very hesitant to throw it all out because I remember hearing it 25 years ago and sneering at it and saying, how can I subvert this in the church that I'm working within? Yet at the same time realizing there were things that I should have been taking on. Yeah.
I mean, notwithstanding God's plan for his church, but where might we be today if the church growth movement never happened, both good and bad, or was it absolutely inevitable?
Was it absolutely? Oh, I don't know. If I say it's absolutely inevitable, that's probably, you know. If I say either thing, it shows how enculturated I am, so I don't know what to say. I think as churches in general, church leaders always seem to be a day late and a dollar short, right? We always say, oh, that's where it's going.
Over there.
We're not that great at going, no one's thinking this way, we're going there. We're not Steve Jobs. We're not going, no one was standing around going, gee, if I only had an iPhone. He came up with it and said, you need this. And we went, yeah, he's right. And it changed everything. Is that right? Because he didn't do a big marketing survey. Who here would like a small computer in your pocket that costs $1,500. It's also your phone, which will do away with cameras and all this other stuff. And none of us, he didn't ask us that, just dreamed it up. So I think always we're going, well, there's a methodology that's working in another framework or a secular frame. And because it's working in the secular frame, it's got a little bit of plausibility because that's the modern world. Let's see if we can pull those levers as well. So in one sense, we've got to be a little bit humble about it and say there's some things that we need to learn from the world and we can pillage from the Egyptians, but you've got to be very careful not to leave Egypt with still an Egyptian mentality, if that's what I'm trying to say. So the first thing that God does with the Israelites when he gets them to Sinai is remind them where they came from and what the problem with it was. And he says, don't start making pyramid schemes in the desert. And because that would have been their issue, that, you know, let's just keep making bricks or getting those people to make bricks and we'll sit up here. And so the gospel's going to have to change that, I think. So, you know, there's so much to say about the movement, but so much of us is embedded in it as well. So we can't self-loathe that much because we've taken on many of these things and said, those are good tools to use. Yeah. I think I'm about done, but Nathan, you got minus 60 seconds.
Right. Eugene comes back to the UK and goes, everything here is religious.
Yeah.
Taylor says, everything's contested in a secular age. The mall seems to be a competition in terms of forming a view of the ends of human life and
the goals,
Smith,
yeah.
Smith does that fun thing where the mall echoes the forms of the cathedral.
Yeah.
When we borrow the forms of the mall who are borrowing the forms of the cathedral, yeah.
Are we?
And is the problem that we take it to the wrong end? We take it to the end of conversion, not the formation of disciples.
Yeah, that's a good one. You see, this, Jamie Smith's going to say that you are shaped by, you love what you do, and then you do what you love. So it's a Mobius strip, isn't it? It's hard to, where do you break that one? And I always use the example of running, that I didn't start to run because I loved running. I didn't buy five pairs of trainers and, you know, a year subscription to Runner's World and then go, I could grow to love this if I read enough about it, and I started to run and then it became a love, and then you do those things. So you're shaped by what you do, you love what you do, and then you're out doing what you love. And I think the mall obviously is the prime example of you go to the mall and you have a social engagement with the mall in such a way that you're saying, I'm the one making a choice here and it's built around how I choose things and this serves my need. And if you translate that contextually to a church that looks like a mall or that kind of framework of thinking, it's so hard to launder out of yourself the idea that I'm a consumer and I'm coming here to ask you the question, what's here for my kids? Not, who's ever been asked, first question, what's your view on end times? Or do you believe in dinosaurs? You're going there and they say, do you have a kids program? Because they want to know those things, because that's how the mall works. That's how we work. We go to the mall, don't we? And so those things are, they're embedded in us. And which came first? Well, Jamie Smith tries to deconstruct that. And I'm actually going to say, I don't think he has his end result. I love the first half of his books and I don't like the second half because he doesn't do the church stuff as well as I think he should do it. And I don't think Taylor is asking the same question. So the key for you guys is you are doing the church thing. You want to know some answers about what the church is going to have to look like as we go into this and how you're going to have to navigate the space. So, but that's an interesting question. And more on Smith later in the week as well. I'm done because I'm taking up your time. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Now, I'm going to give you a 2-minute break. So if you've got a over 40 bladder like I do, I hear you and see you. And I'm going to give you that opportunity. Then we're going to come back, and then we've got guaranteed silver bullets to solve the problem problems of contemporary church. And we're going to do a little bit of a Bible study, and then we're going to integrate stuff. So 2 minutes, use the toilet, run, but then come back because the silver bullets are now.